Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, what were a group of Iranian Shia Muslims doing at the Benedictine Abbey of St. Anselmo here in Rome in mid-September? That's what the Secretary General of Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, Benedictine Father William Skudlarek, tells us. And papal states and all that, the United States and diplomatic relations. Jesuit Professor of Church History at the University of Virginia in the United States, Gerald Fogarty, tells us all about the effects on the papacy of the breach of Porta Pia in 1870. Well, thanks so much for joining me as I bring you the first part in today's broadcast, in which I shine the spotlight on monastic inter-religious dialogue. What were a group of Iranian Shia Muslims doing at the Benedictine Abbey of St. Anselmo here in Rome in mid-September? Well, they were attending a meeting sponsored by a group of monks who promote monastic inter-religious dialogue, one which brought together for 3 days 9 Iranian Shia Muslims and 11 representatives of Western monasticism. But here the plot thickens. Why would an organization such as Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, which by definition deals with all things monastic, sponsor a meeting with a group of people from the International Institute for Islamic Studies of the Iranian city of Qum, given monasticism as an institution does not exist in Islam?
They do not have a monastic order, but they have monastic practices. Most specifically, the fact that they pray 5 times a day, like monks gather for prayer at certain hours of the day.
That was the Secretary General of Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, Benedictine Father William Skudlarek, giving us a taste of what there is in common. He'll explain more of this later on in the programme. But first, he gives me some of the background to this meeting, which, as he told me, stems from a tragic event which took place in Muslim territory, all right, but not in Iran at all, rather in Algeria. You may know the story. It's recounted in a well-known award-winning film. The title is Of Gods and Men, and draws inspiration from a true life story about the French Trappist monks killed at the monastery of Tiberine in 1996, a community led by the prior Christian de Chergé.
They began to be very closely involved with the life of the surrounding Algerian Muslim community. And in fact, Christian de Chergé and several of the monks were involved in a group called the Ribat Es Salam, the Bond of Peace, in which they would come together twice a year with devout Muslims, not for any kind of intellectual or academic discourse, but to share their spiritual insights or their spiritual quest. They were kidnapped by militants in Algeria. They were assassinated in conditions that are not entirely clear. And while Christian de Chergé never published very much, he left a lot of written material that is now being published. His talks to the community, for example, or retreats he gave, in which he really developed what it means for monks, Christian monks, to be involved in dialogue with Muslims and why it was appropriate to do so. And he identified himself as a praying person among people who pray. And it was on that level of prayer or that level of the search for God or being attentive to God's voice, that he felt we as monks could enter into a spiritual dialogue with Muslims, even though, as you pointed out, they do not have a monastic order.
You don't pray five times a day as Benedictines, do you?
Yes. Yeah, but not exactly the same hours. Most monasteries, for example, will have a morning prayer, which we call lauds. They will have a midday prayer. They will have evening prayer, vespers. They will have compline, the night prayer, and then also Eucharist. And many monasteries will also come together for a sixth hour, which are called the vigils, the office of readings. Yeah.
So that was a point in common already.
Very much in common, very much in common. And as a matter of fact, during this meeting here, we made very sure to make a part of the schedule the times for prayer for us as Christians and for them as Muslims, with the freedom to be participant observers at one another's prayer.
So what did you learn from them in terms of prayer?
In terms of prayer, I learned from them such things as the importance of preparing to pray. They take that very seriously.
Ritual.
The rituals, the ritual washing, the cleansing of their mouth with waters, the making sure that their clothing is in good order and appropriate. That whole sense that you don't just start praying. You prepare for that. You recognize what a serious and awe-inspiring act this is to be in communion with God in prayer.
Obviously, you exchanged conversations with these Shiite Muslims. Did they remark on the way you pray as Western monks?
They did. In a sense, this was more a meeting about informing one another about what we do, you know, so that the other was more aware of it. For example, here at Sant'Anselmo, above the door into the church, there is a Latin inscription.
Tell me in English.
As you stand here, because we line up on feast days especially to go into church. But it says something like, as you stand here, don't let your mind wander, because if the mind does not pray, the lips work in vain. And I happened to mention that, and, you know, one of the Muslims in the small group that I was in said, we have exactly the same thing in our tradition. It's not the prayer of the lips that counts, it's the prayer of the heart. To pray with the heart, there needs to be that time of preparation where you empty the heart of all those things about what do I, you know, what do I have to get done for tomorrow? Where am I going? What's on my schedule? You know, all those sorts of things. There needs to be a kind of conscious effort to center oneself if one is to pray well.
Basically, this is a broadening of understanding of monastic interreligious dialogue, isn't it? Because until now, you only had dialogue with monks. This was something revolutionary, wasn't it?
Well, it was in a sense, but as I mentioned, it was in many ways the example of Christian de Chergé who prepared us for this. And it wasn't just because of the movie, but a year before his death, he spoke to a gathering of monastic interreligious dialogue, the European members, who were having an annual meeting, and this one was held in Spain. And his address to the European delegates to that meeting in 1995 was really the beginning of a reflection that when we say monastic interreligious dialogue, we're not only talking about monk to monk or nun to nun, Buddhist to Catholic or Hindu to Catholic, but we are talking about the dialogue of religious experience. And once we came to that recognition that monastic in its broad sense means this kind of dialogue, then the way, of course, was open to dialogue with Muslims. It just took time to finally get it organized and get us actually to do it. I should say, the meeting we had here at Sant'Anselmo in September was the first meeting on this kind of international level. But especially in Europe, also in the United States, there are individual monasteries which are now meeting regularly with their Muslim neighbors. Sometimes just for fellowship, inviting them over for a meal, for example, at the breaking of the Ramadan fast, but sometimes also for more formal kinds of interaction on these spiritual topics.
These meetings are useful in terms of understanding each other. We come from such different types of cultures. I mean, right. We tend to assume that everyone thinks the way we do in the Western world. This is terribly important, isn't it, in terms of dialogue, of looking towards peaceful relations.
Yeah. Let me just give you one little anecdotal kind of incident. At the end of our conference here in September, Abbot Notker Wolf, who was part of the conference, and I...
The Abbot Primate of the Benedictines.
Abbot Primate of the Benedictines, yes. Decided to give a little concert at the end of the session. It was meant to be just a pleasant way to end things.
you play the cello?
I play the cello, he plays the flute, okay? We did a more modern little piece, and then we played a Handel sonata. Very simple things, just kind of pleasant music, house music, or you know, that we did. But at the end, I noticed one of the younger Muslim participants had a very puzzled look on his face. And I asked what he was wanting to ask, and he said, "Now, how is this part of your religious practice as monks?" And I was just completely taken aback by this, but then I recognized that if I were to go to Iran and they were to do something similar, I would not have any idea either whether this was something they did as part of their prayer life or whether it was something they did more as part of their cultural, social, recreational life. I wouldn't know. I have no points of contact. So he, listening to us play a sonata for flute and basso continuo by Handel, thought this was something that we probably, part of our prayer life, you know. Now, I think music for Benedictine monks is a very important part of their prayer life. We spend a lot of time chanting. But when Abbot Notker Wolf and I gave this little concert, we weren't intending to show them how we prayed. We were just intending to give them a pleasant kind of finale to the conference.
A bit of entertainment.
Yeah.
If you were invited to Qom, the holy city of Qom, now in Iran, would you go?
Oh, yes, and we're already thinking about it. We've received an invitation, and yes, I would love to go. I guess it would be a matter of getting a visa. I should also say here, the conference that we had here at Sant Anselmo was in fact a sequel to meetings that had been arranged by Dr. Muhammad Ali Shomali, who was the kind of coordinator of the group of Shia Muslims that was here, and Abbot Timothy Wright, a former abbot of Ampleforth Abbey in England. He and Muhammad Ali Shomali had become friends, and they then put together in England three meetings between Shia Muslims and English monks and theologians, and I think there were a couple of occasions on which Abbot Timothy and some others went to Qom in Iran. He and Shomali wanted to know if it might be possible to do something in Rome. And that's where I got involved as Secretary General for Monastic and Religious Dialogue. And so it became a meeting sponsored officially by Monastic and Religious Dialogue. So this has had a prehistory. Now, it's now taken a little bit of a shift in that it is no longer, as it was in England, mainly a kind of theological exchange. You know, we've now shifted it more to the monastic, that is, spiritual practices, spiritual experience exchange. Theology has to be based on faith and on experience. And unless you have that ground of faith, and that faith that expresses itself in prayer and in the way you live your life, there's nothing to theologize about. And if you don't have that grounding there, theology can become just little mind games, you know, where you kind of play around with concepts. So what I think we are trying to do in monastic interreligious dialogue is provide the data of people's experience, people of different religious traditions who come together to share their experience, and then to allow the theologians then to reflect on that and say, now, what does this mean? What does this mean? Christian de Chergé already began that. You know, Christian de Chergé was very much involved in this dialogue of religious experience, but I'm reading a book about him now in which he says, and I'll quote it in French first, dire Dieu autrement, c'est pas dire un autre Dieu. Because we speak of God differently doesn't mean we're speaking about different gods. Now, that's a theological issue. What does it mean to speak about God differently, but not to speak about a different God? But that's the experience that Christian de Chergé had out of his meeting with these devout Muslim neighbors of his, that they spoke of God differently, but they're speaking of the same God. Now, let the theologians figure that out. You know, what does that mean? What does that mean? How can that be true?
I'm sure the Shia Muslims were constantly quoting from the Quran.
Constantly. I mean, this is, and in Arabic. You know, I mean, they would always do it in Arabic and then give us the translation. And I think that was one of the things that was both a point of commonality, because their Everything is so rooted in the Holy Quran, in the revelation made to Muhammad, that they are just constantly quoting it, constantly quoting it. It can come across to us, at least to me sometimes, as sort of what we would call biblicism, you know, or using proof texts out of the Bible, just kind of picking verses out of the Bible to prove your point. That's how it sounds to me sometimes. And I was cautioned by one of the Catholic monks here not to impose my own categories on their practice. I think what really happened over the 3 days was that we got to know one another and we began to sense that we were friends with one another. And I am convinced that unless friendship is established with followers of other religions, anything else really makes no sense. There has to be that friendship and that trust that eventually enables us not only to speak about our own experience, but even to ask some questions that otherwise might seem to be too invasive.
And our thanks there go to the Secretary General of Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, Benedictine Father William Skudlarik. And now moving on in our broadcast, why not turn the pages of our Vatican history book by going back to a date which put an end to the Papal States. The date is September the 20th, 1870. Stay tuned. Ever heard of the breach of Porta Pia when on September the 20th, 1870, the 12th Battalion of the Bersaglieri charged into Rome, opening with their cannons an entrance into the old Aurelian walls of Rome, a dozen metres west of the Michelangelesque gate, which stands there to this day. A gate located in a straight line with the Quirinal Palace, which had been, until that day, the residence of the Roman Pontiff to head the Papal States. Papal States that after that breach no longer existed, as the unity of Italy with this military operation completed the process of political unification. From that day on, the Pope of the time, Pius IX, retreated to the Vatican, and the Quirinal Palace became the residence first of the kings of Italy and then, as from 1946, of the presidents of the Republic of Italy. That's what I knew, but what I wondered about was whether Pius IX had retreated across the Tiber of his own will. So I put that question to church historian, Jesuit, Professor Gerald Fogarty.
By and large, it was. The Italian Parliament in 1872 passed the Law of Guarantees, giving him certain monetary contribution for the loss of his temporal power. It wasn't that much, really. Nevertheless, he, in protest, moved into the Vatican and became the self-imposed prisoner of the Vatican.
Of course, the Vatican City-State, as we know it today, didn't exist at the time. That only came into being with the so-called Lateran Pacts in 1929. Curiously, the United States, though, had relations with the Vatican long before it came into being as a state.
The United States did have diplomatic relations with the Papal States, which were broken off in 1867. Actually, they weren't broken off. The United States Congress refused funding for it, but it was part of what we call Reconstruction after the American Civil War, where this radical group took over Congress after the assassination of Lincoln. So technically speaking, diplomatic relations continued. We might come back to that because in 1983, that was the first step towards establishing diplomatic relations, was to repeal that legislation.
Anyway, we're still in 1870.
We're still in 1870.
So I wonder, what did Pius IX's choice to be voluntary prisoner in the Vatican entail for the popes who came after him for 52 years after that? Leo XIII, Pius X, Benedict XV, and halfway through of Pius XI. So 52 years. What did this entail for popes and more broadly for the Catholic Church?
Well, in some ways, beginning with Pius IX, he became a martyr pope. He had been very popular with the people initially, but then they turned against him. one has to be careful of how public opinion sways back and forth. So by the time of the overthrow of temporal power, he was no longer popular. And nevertheless, he was seen as the martyr pope by Catholics around the world because he was now the prisoner of the Vatican. Now, from my viewpoint, working mainly in the United States-Vatican relations, or Holy See relations, by and large, except for the Italian community, it didn't mean that much, although there were protests against the loss of temporal power. Now, you have to keep in mind the Italian-Americans who went to the United States at that time. There wasn't that sense of nationality. But also it meant that they didn't have the same loyalty to the Pope that, say, the Irish-Americans would. Because to have a united Italy, you had to end temporal power. So therefore, it wasn't the source of nationhood as it was for the Irish and later the Poles. But nevertheless, there were protests against it, but the American Catholic leaders were somewhat hesitant to say too much, for instance, when the statue of Giordano Bruno was put up.
Which is now in Campo di Fiore.
Yeah,
Rome,
that's right.
Rome.
And most people don't know why it was put there, but he was supposed to be the pioneer of religious liberty in the sense that they were using it in the Kingdom of Italy. And the United States hierarchy, the bishops, were asked to protest it. Well, it was already there. And Cardinal Gibbons, the only cardinal in the United States, the Archbishop of Baltimore, said, well, nobody took any notice of it when it was put up. So now to have a protest would make the wrong impression. Catholics were still struggling to prove they were truly American, and they weren't subject to a temporal power under the Pope. So that was always the dilemma for the popes, for the Catholic people, the dilemma of their attitude towards the popes, I should say.
But getting back to Rome and the Catholic Church or more broadly.
Well, by and large, remember that 1870 meant the establishment of the Third Republic in France, the Second German Empire, after the French were defeated in the Battle of Sedan, all in 1870. As a matter of fact, it was not accidental. From 1850 on, the Pope was kept in Rome, really, by French troops. They had to withdraw the French troops to fight against the Prussians, and then that led to the entry of the Italian army troops into the city of Rome. As far as the Pope was concerned, therefore, there was a usurpation, if you will. So by and large, within the continent, it meant the same effect took place, that it meant that there's a whole different relationship now with the Pope, who was no longer a monarch in any sense. In the English-speaking countries, it was a bit different because they never had the same thing. In Great Britain, Catholics were a minority. In the United States, they were a minority. And nevertheless, it's under Leo XIII, that begins in 1878, that there's an increase in missionary endeavor. So even though the Pope is now sort of isolated in that little acreage over there that we're looking at, but our listeners can't hear it, that we're looking at it, they can't see we're looking at.
103 acres,
I think, yeah. Translated into hectares or square meters, whatever you want to do. Just as an aside, during the Second World War, there was this rumor that the Vatican would be satisfied to have an airport there. Well, somebody pointed out. There wasn't room for an airfield, but nevertheless.
The space people, just for a heliport.
Yeah. But for the most part, it meant the papacy was taking a whole different role. And one of the things that would emerge gradually was it was strictly a spiritual role. When there was temporal power, it meant that the Pope had to deal with other countries as another temporal leader did. So it took a while to realize that ultimately this was going to be a blessing in disguise. In fact, in the 1890s, there was a group headquartered pretty much around Cremona and Milan, that was what up in northern Italy. And they were working for ending the Roman question by adapting the American approach to the separation of church and state. It worked to give freedom to the church in the United States. Maybe they could do the same thing here. That did not float well with Vatican officials, or the Holy See is the better term to use at this point, because if you speak of the Vatican, it's just the one palace. And Vatican City State did not come into being until 1929.
One question that people always ask themselves is, in 1870, the Pope retired to the Vatican. What was there? Because the Popes lived in the Lateran Palace, and then they lived in the Quirinal.
Yeah,
then,
well, it
so
was...
So why did he go to the Vatican?
It was originally the Summer Palace, because it was on the other side of the Tiber River. It was a little bit cooler.
Well, it wasn't built up in those days. It was.
It wasn't. No,
it was
that's
woodland.
True. Yeah. In fact, it wasn't until Mussolini that a lot of this area was built up. So the 1920s and 30s. But that was the main reason for choosing it, is that he could defend it, for one thing. And the lines of Vatican City State were where the papal army stopped fighting, basically. There was a famous Italian general, Nino Bixio. There's a Nino Bixio street or something almost every Italian town. And he said if he had the privilege of entering the city, he'd burn the Vatican down too. Now, his brother, by the way, was a Jesuit. Some Italian writers claim that it was the brother who was the real rogue and had the influence on Nino. But Giuseppe Bixio, Joseph Bixio, worked in the United States for a good part of his time, and he was quite colorful. But anyway, just where Nino Bixio's troops stopped, really, is where under General Codorna, is where Vatican City came into being.
In 1870, there was a papal court in place. They reacted to the fact that the Pope was relegated to the Vatican of his own will.
Well, much of the nobility went with him, but there were two nobilities then, because you had the black nobility, which was the papal nobility, and you had the white nobility, which was the royal nobility, which, of course, one...
Because white was the color of the Savoy family. And,
yeah. And everyone would think, don't you have it wrong? Nope, it was the
and
white
the black
nobility.
Black aristocracy used to dress with black mantillas when they went to audience to the Pope.
Which is still the case. Hmm. When a woman visits the Pope, she has to wear this black dress and black mantilla.
Well, theoretically. It doesn't happen a lot these days, except on official occasions, like, for example, when Michelle Obama was received in audience by Pope Benedict, she dressed in black or black mantilla. What still takes place, though, is the privilege held by Catholic monarchs, obviously women or consorts of Catholic monarchs, to wear white. The Pope, when he was a prisoner in the Vatican, he still continued, despite losing temporal power, acting and speaking for the whole church scene.
Oh, yes. And also he maintained his own diplomatic corps, which was recognized by the Lateran treaties, that he could maintain his own diplomatic corps. And freedom of communication, certainly with the cardinals, for instance, in the conclave of 1915, the Italian government provided a special train to meet the cardinals coming in from abroad, and special cars and everything. So that was recognized, even though they were still technically at war with one another, for lack of better terms. And I know 1915, 1922, they did that. And then after that, then it was sort of a recognition. So it was a strange relationship, because most listeners probably are not aware that there are now over 100 nations that have diplomatic relations with the Holy See. None of their embassies are inside the city, of Vatican City. There's not enough room there. And therefore, they're spread throughout the city of Rome, which is the capital of the Italian Republic. So they're in a foreign country.
And our thanks there go to Father Gerald Fogarty, a church historian who teaches church history at the University of Virginia in the United States. He'll be back with us sometime soon. And that's really all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this program. I'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.